Welcome to Mayo Clinic Educator Central, brought to you by the Learning Solutions Center at Mayo Clinic. Hi, I'm your host, Stacey Kraft. Thanks for joining us. Today we are going to explore the infamous theory of learning styles. What are they? Why are they so popular? Is there any evidence to support it? And how can we navigate through this while staying focused on creating quality, effective education? Today, I am just so thrilled to have with us Dr. Tisha Marshak to discuss and unpack this seemingly complicated topic. A little background, Dr. Tisha Marshak is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, where she specializes in educational and developmental psychology. Her research focuses on understanding social cognitive predictors of teachers' and students' motivations and developing interventions for improving academic outcomes. Recently, she was involved in the American Associations of State Colleges and Universities Reimagining the First Year Initiative, where she co-developed and implemented mindset and belonging interventions aimed at improving diverse undergraduate students' success. Dr. Marshak also uses her teaching and research expertise to debunk pseudoscience and misinformation and to promote open-mindedness, critical self-reflection, and organizational change. So welcome, Tisha.
Thank you. I'm excited for this conversation.
To get us started, what got you interested in this topic?
Well, I'm an educational and developmental psychologist by training. So I've always had an interest in, you know, understanding how we learn or how people learn and ultimately identifying ways that we can use to promote or enhance development, separating, you know, what works and what doesn't, and ultimately just trying to improve learning. More broadly, you know, I've just always had philosophical interests in kind of questioning commonly held beliefs that we have and behaviors, and more generally understanding why people believe what they believe and why we do what we do.
So I talk about learning styles a bit and people's belief in them. Why don't you introduce us to what learning styles are? I know a lot of, you know, may say that they're a visual learner or they're a tactile learner or something, and maybe that's what they think learning styles is. But
yeah, sure. Well, learning styles, it's a theory about how our minds work. So the assumption is that we all have, or the major assumption is that all of us have one inherently best way to think and process information, one dominant style of thinking that helps us learn everything. And the idea is this is something that's kind of innate in us that we're born with. And our job is to kind of figure out what is the best way that we learn, and then ideally to learn in that way. Probably the most well-known version you kind of alluded to is the VAK model, which has actually been updated to, it's called the VARK, which stands for visual, auditory, reading, and kinesthetic. That's mm-hmm. the one I think that people are most familiar with. And again, the idea is that you're either a visual learner, an auditory learner, you learn through reading, or you learn through doing things. That's the kinesthetic one. But actually, if you look at the literature on this, it's been around for, I don't know, maybe 100 years or so. I think since the 1940s, I believe, is when it was initially proposed. But there's actually, and this is one of the challenges with this idea in and of itself, is that there's actually something like 70 different versions of learning styles that have actually been proposed. So the VARK model is the most common, but other theorists have said we're either assimilators or explorers, or we're reflective thinkers versus being more intuitive, or organizers versus innovators. I mean, that's just, you know, a sampling of all the different styles that have been proposed. Some people will also mistakenly refer to Gardner's theory of multiple intelligences as a learning styles theory. I don't know if you've heard of that one. Well, so Gardner's theory of intelligence, he ultimately said there's 8 or 9 different specific types of intelligence. So I won't list them all, but visual spatial is one, mathematical, musical, kinesthetic, those are examples. But he's actually opposed to the interpretation of his theory being a learning styles theory. It's just a common misapplication. He said, yes, people vary in these different skills or different types of intelligences, but he never, and actually is adamantly opposed to this idea that if, for example, you're high in musical intelligence, that you can learn everything musically. In his mind, those are just separate types of intelligence.
So the learning styles theory, as you said, has been around for a really long time. Why do you think, well, first off, before I dig into why it's so popular, is it real?
Is it true?
So it kind of depends on what you mean. And I think this is, I think getting to your question of why is it so popular, I think people mean different things when they talk about learning styles, and there's some confusion about what exactly we're saying. So if you're saying, or if you're asking, do people have different ability levels and do people have different interests? So some people like to do things with their hands and some people like listening to things, then the answer is definitively yes. Research very clearly shows that people have different ability levels across domains, and again, different interests and motivations and things like that. But if you're asking, is there evidence that all of us have kind of one way that we learn everything best, or that learning in our preferred style helps us learn better? The answer to that is no. At this point, there's no strong or definitive research that actually shows that we have one style that we learn everything best in.
And I hear often that, hey, I can't pay attention to this, or I can't learn that because I'm a hands-on learner. So until you give me application or something, I can't learn it. Or I'm a visual learner, so I can't listen to this and I can't retain it or whatever. And I think that is different than that you can't retain or learn from various modalities or whatever. It's different than a preference.
Absolutely. And again, that's another point of confusion, I think, where we could say, do people have preferences? And again, the answer is certainly yes. Many of us have preferences where, like you said, if I'm given the choice of how would I want to learn something, do I want to see it? Do I want to hear it? Do I want to do it? Do I want to read it? Many of us could answer that question. But again, when we've actually tested that scientifically, so let's say you prefer to see things or you think you're a visual learner, when we actually put you in situations where we have you learn something visually in your preferred style, and in other styles, there's actually no difference in your ability to learn that content. The only exception is that the content itself matters. But that's not because somebody has a specific learning styles. It really depends on what it is that you're trying to teach or to learn. So for example, if I wanted to teach someone, or if I was trying to learn what the shape of the state of Minnesota looks like, or how to find Rochester on a map, then visualization is probably going to work best for everybody, not just me because I think I'm a visual learner. It's because the nature of the task itself, it fits with this idea of actually being able to visualize. Or if I wanted to teach someone what a certain style of music sounds like or how to speak another language, then hearing it is probably going to be best. Again, we wouldn't say, oh, I'm a visual learner, so in order to learn how to speak Spanish, I've got to see it first. That's probably just not going to work. So again, the idea, it's not based on your learning style, but it's actually the content itself that matters.
And I'm looking at this article which I had pulled up called The Myth of Learning Styles, and it was published in Change
This is
Magazine.
Reiner and Willingham, I believe.
Yes, yep, that's the article. And I love this article because I feel like it's very it's not full of a lot of jargon, it's not super dense, and it lays out the case for why learning styles are and how that we think of them typically are not accurate.
Yeah, I mean, there's been several, right? Several studies. So let me say, there's a lot of research on this topic. And some of the earlier research, those researchers tried and theorists tried to provide support for learning styles, or made arguments that the research supported this idea that we actually do learn better in our preferred learning style. But when you actually look at the details of those studies, they were oftentimes flawed in significant ways, where they didn't control for things like motivation or background knowledge, and ability level and things like that. Or they had really small sample sizes where, okay, well, if you're only looking at 8 or 10 people, you might find a difference, but because your sample size is so small, that reduces the likelihood or the probability that those results weren't just a fluke of some sort. So, when we say there's no definitive evidence to support learning styles, we're looking at the bigger picture across all those studies and considering those limitations, focusing more on the studies that had good controls. It's those studies where we see, okay, well, after we control for X, Y, and Z, your preference doesn't actually make a difference.
Right, in the actual learning outcome, or how much you retain or what you can learn.
Yeah.
So, with all of that being said, why then do you think that the belief continues to perpetuate and be out there? I mean, I think there's a certain it feels innate, like it just for some reason feels right. And that's partly what I think when I talk to people about it. You know, hey, I know it just seems to make sense. It seems like almost common sense, right, that this would be true, but it's not. And we have all this evidence. It's not just a few research articles, right? We have a lot of evidence saying it's not true. So then why do you think it continues to persevere?
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head there, is that it's intuitively appealing. It seems to make sense. It seems to be true. It makes us feel good to recognize individual differences. I think, you know, oftentimes, especially in education, we feel like we're overlooking students and we're not valuing or accepting of diversity and things like that. And so this is a way, by saying we have learning styles and we're going to account for them and we're going to adjust for them in some way, it's a way to, you know, make us feel good about treating people as individuals. So I think there's a lot of good intentions behind it. But again, as we've said, at the end of the day, it really doesn't enhance learning or make a difference in the ways that we think it does. However, again, when we ask people, so scientifically, we find that it doesn't have any evidence. But when we ask people, you know, if you think you're a visual learner, you know, why do you believe that? People can give all sorts of anecdotal evidence, you know, looking back on their experiences of like, well, I was never good at this subject, and that's because there aren't visuals in it. Or, you know, I remember taking that class and that teacher didn't use any PowerPoint slides and all they did was talk and I failed that class. Therefore, you know, there's more evidence that I must be a visual learner and I can't learn in that way.
Well, that doesn't take into account, however, the educator designed their education. So even if they didn't give a PowerPoint and they just talked, what did they talk about? Did they ramble endlessly without like context? did they engage the learners with stories or, you know, other elements of what quote unquote the buzzword sticky to make it sticky, right? So when you just sort of blanket statement and say, well, I'm a visual learner because I had this person didn't have visuals, this education I involved in didn't have visuals and I couldn't learn, or hey, I had to read a book and because I couldn't do the thing that they're asking me to do, I couldn't remember the concept or something, you know?
Right, and then you also have a lot of the confirming examples where you can say, yeah, I really struggled with this, but then once someone drew it for me, all of a sudden it clicked. And then in our minds, that's again further evidence that, oh, it must be because seeing it is what helped me learn. And you're right, we can't, just in looking at our own experiences, we can't isolate or separate all those different things that could be contributing to learning in any given situation. And then that's the value of science, right? Is it allows us to kind of separate those factors and see at the end of the day what's really making a difference.
Yeah, and in your example of, oh, I saw someone draw it and suddenly now I understand. I mean, you know, you could think that there's so many explanations for that aren't I'm a visual learner. There could be that is maybe just a piece of the full learning package that needed to happen
for it
to come together. And maybe your previous learning experience was deficient in some way in the way that it was presented to you. Or maybe you were really tired when you took it. You know, there's like personal elements too.
Or just the simple repetition of, you know, being exposed to it again. Sometimes that's what it, you know, it takes a certain amount of times before it really clicks.
Yeah.
There's no guarantee that had you been shown that image from the beginning that you know, you would have understood it. Yeah, I think it's definitely an oversimplification. And it's not, you know, an inherent fault of people. It's not, you know, just laziness, or it's not an inherent lack of critical thinking. It's just our brains, the way our minds work, we can't, it's hard for us to, again, simultaneously consider and analyze all these different things that go into learning and to try to figure out what it is. So we tend to take, just like in all ways of our thinking, we tend to take the shortcuts. Like the easiest answer seems to be the best answer, and we kind of go with that. And then you build on a lifetime of experiences where you have this belief and you see evidence to confirm it, and you ignore all the times, all the evidence that doesn't confirm it. So again, if you think you're a visual learner, you ignore all the times that you learned even when there wasn't a visual. And that strengthens that belief, you know, over time. And then, as you said, it's just so common. You hear it everywhere. I mean, you hear it from your educators growing up. You hear it from parents sometimes. You hear it from friends. I know every time, every year when they're updating my file or my kid's file, the nurses will ask me, what is your learning style or what is your kid's learning style? It's just, you know, it's a matter of habit and documentation, that it's something that you don't even society doesn't cause you to even question whether or not this is true. And you combine that with the intuitive appeal, and you know, that helps to explain why it just continues to persist over time.
Well, and because it's so common knowledge in a way, and like it isn't a special piece of information that just like people in education talk about in the little corners of academia, right, or whatever, it's become, you know, pop culture in some ways. Mm-hmm. That permeates down to all learners, really. And so my question here is, so what is the detriment of this then? Why does it matter? So if it feels intuitive and people like it, it makes them feel good, and why does it matter if you believe in this or not?
That's a good question. I get that all the time. And I think sometimes people think I'm just trying to be curmudgeon-y about this. Like, oh, I hate learning styles. Don't believe it. But again, if it makes us feel good and it, you know, doesn't seem to be hurting, then what's the problem? But I think for me, it comes down to two things. And one is that teachers are incredibly limited in resources and time, and students already differ in so many other ways that research shows does affect their learning, that it does matter. Again, things like background knowledge and ability level and interests and home life and all of that, that we really can't afford to be doing things in education. We can't afford to be using strategies like promoting learning styles that don't have any support, where the research just shows it's not going to make a difference. You know, it comes down to resources. And at the end of the day, I think we should be putting our resources, time and money, into strategies that actually have some support. So even if this does sound really great, at the end of the day, if there's no evidence that it works, I don't think we can afford to be taking that risk of, you know, indulging this idea and feeling good about it if it's not actually making a difference.
I totally agree with that. And I also think that perpetuating the idea with learners and, you know, when they come in to an educational experience thinking that they are either a kinesthetic or a visual learner or a critical thinker, you know, the different, I know there are tons of different mm-hmm. takes on this learning style thing. I think that could also be harmful in that it sets the student up for failure if what they're receiving doesn't fit their preconceived notion of how they're supposed to learn. And it gives them an excuse maybe to not do well and to sort of write it off.
Yeah, so that's my other primary concern, is that I think it could result in that we're limiting ourselves or we're limiting our students if we're only you know, trying to learn or trying to teach in one way because we think we have to do that. Then you're exactly right, that can result in this kind of fixed mindset where, you know, we shut down or we turn off when material isn't presented in our preferred mode. And that, you know, as you said, that could actually be potentially dangerous, as we're promoting this fixed mindset when in actual, that the good news, and I do think it's good news in many ways that learning styles don't exist, is because what that says is that we are all more or less capable of learning in a variety of ways. Yeah. And that's a good thing.
Yeah, I would agree. I also think it's harmful in collecting data too. So if you have a learning asset that you've made, some kind of course or education, and a lot of people don't do well on it or in it, don't fare well, don't like it for whatever reason, if you're trying to collect their feedback or their, you know, qualitative feedback on what's going on, they may give you information about how it doesn't meet their learning style or they need this or that, and that, how are you supposed to act on that, right? And you may be then in a pickle if your people around you believe in learning styles, then you might be directed to accommodate these comments and then continue to perpetuate, you know, mm-hmm. this cycle that doesn't actually impact.
Well, simultaneously maybe ignoring other things that actually do matter. So, you know, you're focusing on one thing thinking that's the cause of the problem when actually it's something entirely different that you're not even paying attention to. You know, there is research that says in general, doing multimodal teaching can be beneficial, if not just for the sake of mixing it up and, you know, changing, recapturing students' attention and interest, but also because, and that's another important point, is that I would say most content or most things that we want to teach in the classroom are not resigned to only one modality in the first place. Mm-hmm. So again, like teaching, let's say I want to teach math. You know, even so, before I mentioned how it's important to focus on the content, and certain content, certain modalities might fit the content better. But I would say most things actually require multimodalities. So if I'm teaching math, it's probably beneficial for students to visualize it, to actually see what they're doing. And but it's also probably simultaneously beneficial for me to be explaining or verbalizing, here mm-hmm. are the steps that I'm taking as they watch me do it. Just like it's probably also beneficial for them to actually practice solving those math problems. So, you know, there's an example where incorporating multi-senses actually makes sense. We shouldn't feel this pressure to incorporate every single modality in every single lesson. So like, you know, if you thought music was a learning style, musical was a learning style, we shouldn't feel pressure to make a music a part of every single thing that we teach.
Right. Well, what's interesting, what you just said, though, about, you know, those elements, like maybe you have to visualize it and you have to talk through it and then also practice it. That is not learning styles to me. That is just good educational design, curriculum design, you know, that's just good practice, best practice.
Right. And it increases the likelihood that students get meaning, you know, that learning experience is meaningful to them, which that is what's going to enhance their learning, in addition to the practice and the repetition and being able to see something from kind of multiple angles. Yeah.
Earlier, you had a little bit of a differentiation between learning styles and learning preferences, right? Like someone may say, I really like music, right? I enjoy music. And if something is musical, I'm in, right? Well, how does preference impact learning? And how much should we as educators be concerned about our learners' preferences?
Well, so again, this idea that your learning style preference enhances learning, that hasn't been supported. So if we're just looking at it on that level, then the answer is we shouldn't care at all what students' preferences are, and we should be focusing on, the content and what makes sense in light of what we want students to actually learn. There is the sense that, you know, preference could influence their motivation in some ways. We talked about how, you know, believing that you have this style or even just preferring to learn a certain way could actually decrease your motivation when it doesn't match. Some people have questioned whether, you know, the opposite is also true, that if you're taught in your preferred style, that could actually enhance your motivation. And because you're more engaged and more interested, you actually learn more. To my knowledge, that direct hypothesis hasn't been tested, but I'm less inclined to think that would actually be strongly supported either, just because, as we've already alluded to, all these other factors are more important when it comes to learning. Like, I could prefer to learn musically, but that's probably not going to help me learn, you know, how to sculpt. Even if I love music, it's not going to teach me how to be a sculptor or how to distinguish, you know, two different artists' techniques or something like that.
Yeah, and I would question how that really impacts your motivation to learn. There's a lot of research that has supported that motivation that impacts your learning outcomes is more tied to intrinsic motivation for the topic or content or your outcome, not how you're learning it.
Yeah, so. Well, and that's the other thing. There's been some studies that show that even if you think you have a certain learning style, when you actually put in a learning situation, you don't necessarily stick to learning strategies or study strategies that are consistent with that style. There was just a newer study in 2018 where they looked at that. They gave people a learning styles questionnaire to try to determine what their preference was, and then they gave them a task, and they asked them, and they gave them a study skills inventory, and then they gave them a task and asked them, like, what did you do here, or how would you prepare? And there was actually no correlation between their learning style and strategies that actually fit with that supposed learning style.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And so, really? And again, what that shows is that even if we think we have a learning style, in the moment, we're actually adapting. Most of us are adapting as needed based on the task requirements anyways.
And that makes sense, because that actually is how we learn, right?
I think upon just a little bit more critical reflection, the theory itself does start to fall apart, or at least I think it's relatively easy to see how, oh, wait a minute, that's not right. It's just getting people to do that sometimes that can be hard. And that reminds me, this part of a conversation, you know, it brings me back to how we measure it. And again, usually the way we assess learning styles is just through it's a survey or a questionnaire that asks people, you know, it gives them a bunch of different scenarios. So if you were learning how to play a new game, like a new board game, would you rather watch others play and then play it yourself? Would you rather listen to somebody tell you the instructions? Would you rather look at a diagram that outlines it or read the instructions? And then we have them answer a bunch of scenarios like that. And whichever response gets the most responses, then we say, okay, that's your preference. But the majority of people, when they complete these questionnaires, don't actually show a really strong singular preference for one method over another. Most people, you know, they have two or sometimes three, sometimes four scores that are kind of comparable or similar, where maybe they got 9 for visual and 8 for auditory and 7 for reading. And I don't know, maybe they got 3 for kinesthetic. But then it becomes difficult, like, okay, technically their high score was for visual. Does that really mean they're a visual learner when, you know, they were scoring 8 and 7? Again, I'm making these numbers up.
Sure.
And what it really points to is that, again, it depends on the question, because for some of those questions on the survey, based on the content, I'd rather do this. But for other questions, I'd rather do this.
And maybe that outcome doesn't correlate with how they have previously identified themselves. You know, maybe they think that they are a kinesthetic learner or whatever. But this survey you've just described might show that, no, you're all of them, right?
Yeah. And I've had students tell me that before where, yeah, I took that survey and it either they'll say, I really didn't agree with the result, or my results were similar. And so my teacher just said, okay, well, pick one, you know? And that, right. Again, that's more of this, like, okay, instead of latching onto that and using that to, like, inform some skepticism about this, we just kind of brush it off and say, oh, no, it must be true. I'm just going to, you know, ignore that detail.
Right. Well, so here's an interesting question, I think. Like, so it seems like learning styles is closely tied to people's identities. Like, they might own it and it's part of their education identity. I'm using air quotes over here on my side. I'm making that phrase up. But as a learner, I might say my identity is that I love hands-on or whatever, and I'll always go to that as my go-to. How do we as educators accommodate the learners without perpetuating the learning styles myth while still respecting their individual identity without, you know, harming them? Because I often feel like, you know, when I answer somebody who has proposed that a statement, like, I am a blank learner, so I can't follow this, that it almost feels like an attack on them as a person. And that would be counterproductive too, right? Because that would alienate learners and make them feel bad. And how do we grapple with that?
Yeah, that's definitely a challenge. You're exactly right that the more people self-identify with that and the longer they've believed it, the more likely you are going to get that defensive reaction of, you know, how dare you say that I don't know myself or that I'm not the way that I think I am, especially when, again, they have all this anecdotal evidence over the years to support that, support that belief. And again, you consider, again, who's telling them that they have a learning style. It often comes from trusted people in their lives, like teachers they've had and parents. And so that adds on to some of that, I think, defensiveness of, you know, who do you think you are telling me that this isn't true? I don't have an easy answer for that. I would say, you know, helping them, asking questions like some of and having conversations like some of what we've talked about today, like asking them, well, you know, if you were learning how to speak a foreign language versus how to cook, do you think the way you'd prefer to answer those or prefer to learn in those situations, would it be different? Like, bringing those kind of examples to their awareness, I think can help, you know, in a non-threatening way. Just, you know, that's okay, but what if you were learning this versus this? Would your approach differ? But also, I think as educators, a lot of it is in kind of demonstrating to them instead of just telling them you can learn in different ways, really trying to demonstrate that to them by encouraging them to try different strategies, for example. So I know you think you're not a visual learner, but I'd really like you to try to, you know, use this model, or I'm going to give you these figures to help you and see what happens, you know, see if this actually enhances your learning compared to when you weren't using those. Or I know you say you're not, you don't learn through reading, but I'd really like you to try, you know, to read this or something and then see if it makes a difference in your score, in your test scores, or in your performance on a certain task. Sometimes that obviously can be a little bit more convincing, because then it's proving to them or showing them that, look, you're still capable of learning even when you use strategies or approaches that are not consistent with what you think is your style. I think that can be helpful as well. One thing that I found that's effective too sometimes is just simply asking people, if I said I wanted to teach you something, how do you want to learn it? Do you want to see it? Do you want to read it? Do you want to hear it? Or do you want to do it? Would you even be able to answer that question without knowing what it was that I was going to teach you? I mean, realistically, if I just said, okay, you're going to learn something. Do you want to see it, hear it, do it, or read it? I think many of us would have a hard time answering that. And, you know, we would have that natural follow-up question of, well, what is it? And
exactly.
I think that's, yeah, so that I think is another really good example or just simple question you can ask to someone to at least plant a little seed of doubt of, oh, you're right. Like, it depends on what I'm learning. And again, if I was being asked to sculpt something versus to solve a math problem versus to learning how to play music, my answers to those questions might very well differ, which is more evidence that not only am I capable of doing things in multiple ways, but maybe my preference, you know, also varies depending on the task itself.
Yeah. And I had some ideas that popped in my head when you were talking is I wonder if like reframing it to a learner, like, well, I know your learning preference is this, but, you know, don't limit yourself. Maybe putting it as like a positive in the sense that like, let's, you know, you're limiting yourself. And I know that you can do more than that. And I know that you may prefer, you know, group activities or whatever, but let's try solitary reading. You know, I believe in you that you could do it. I don't know, that's hokey. That's coming out of my mind. There's no evidence for that. I'm just brainstorming ideas.
No, I do think that's helpful. Again, it's separating this idea that you have a style from preference, and you're acknowledging that some of this is true. Like, sure, you can have a preference, and yes, you might have higher ability. You might be really good at music or really good at working with your hands. It doesn't mean you have to do everything that way all the time. Let's explore these other options, or let's, you know, try these other strategies. And
I would maybe argue that boring is boring is boring, and hard is hard is hard. So whether you read it, or you're watching a video on it, or you're having to listen to a podcast on it, or what, if it's boring, if it's just not something you're into, it's going to be really hard either way, right?
Yeah. And I think podcasts are a great example. I mean, we keep giving this example of a visual learner. Again, many people who are visual learners are the same people who listen to podcasts regularly. And that would be a great example to point out to them. You know, you say you're a visual learner, but how does that explain then, you know, this regular podcast series that you listen to and rave about? Or for people that think they're a kinesthetic learner, you know, many of them love TED Talks and will watch a TED Talk and, you know, rave about that and learn something new that way. So I think the more we can point out counterexamples like that, that can also be helpful in getting people to realize, oh yeah, I guess I do learn in many different ways. I think another key point too, you know, said you were mentioning being gentle about how you phrase it as preferences versus styles, but I think empathy is really important. And, you know, that's why anytime I teach about learning styles or I talk about learning styles, I do try to empathize and have that discussion of why this belief is so appealing and why people believe it. It's not, again, that people are stupid or that people, you know, don't care or that teachers are doing this because they have bad intentions and they're horrible teachers. In fact, it's the opposite. Again, people are trying to understand ourselves and our learners, our students better. We're trying to do the right thing. We're trying to recognize individuality. And I think that can help lower the defenses too. And it's also true, you know, sometimes I'll get the response, well, just because research doesn't show support now doesn't mean it won't ever, right? You can't prove it doesn't work. It's logically impossible to prove a negative. You can't prove that something doesn't exist. The burden of proof lies on the person to prove that it does exist or that it does work. So, you know, that's one way I would respond to that. But also, I try to stay open-minded myself. And you know, I'm the first one to say, look, if maybe we just haven't tested it the right way or the right version of it, or, you know, maybe there is some variation or some situation in which this really does make a difference. And if that's the case, I would love to read that research, and I would love to see that. And I would be, at least I hope I would be one of the first people to say, hey, look, we actually do have evidence now. This is great. this really does make a difference and we should be doing this. But until that day comes, or until, you know, there's a substantial amount of research that supports that, I just don't think we can afford to you know, waste our time and resources, again, promoting this theory that just doesn't work.
Well, yeah, and again, back to the detriment of it, I think it goes beyond just like a structured educational experience and pitters out into people's daily lives, yeah, into how they can or can't absorb regular information around them. With all the learning styles information out there, the misinformation and belief in it, and how that impacts learners and how they see themselves and how they interact with materials, how can educators navigate learner belief and learning styles, and how can we use the information out there, I mean, in any way to our benefit, or do we just ignore it and move on? You know, are there any solid tips?
I tend to think that disabusing people of this learning styles belief is important for the reasons that we've discussed, for the potential problems it creates. But even if you don't want to go that route and want to just ignore it and just forget about it and pretend that it's not there, there are a ton of books and again, research articles out there, if you want to go straight to the source, that do provide evidence for certain types of teaching practices and strategies. There's also a lot of kind of general principles out there that tend to transcend across all domains. We've alluded to some of them a little bit, and that's, you know, being cognizant or being careful about the amount of information you present at once, because people can only handle so much information at once. So things like allowing breaks or spacing out, you know, key concepts or key content can be really helpful. And it really depends. I mean, teaching and learning go hand in hand, but we could look at the research on teaching strategies and get recommendations from that perspective. We could also look at the research on learning strategies and get, you know, recommendations from that perspective. If we're looking at like what learning strategies tend to be most effective, what should we be promoting in our students? Those are things like practice testing. And that, again, depends on the context and the content. Mm-hmm. You want to practice testing yourself in whatever way you are going to actually be tested. Again, spacing it out from the learner's perspective when you're studying is also really beneficial, instead of cramming. I think everybody has heard that cramming doesn't work. Really trying to connect to the material. So this one kind of applies to both sides, the teaching and learning side. As a teacher, the more we can make whatever we're teaching relevant to our students in whatever context, the more we can help them see why this matters or how they can use this content or provide examples from their lives, either their personal or professional lives, the more it's going to resonate with them. Likewise, from the learner's perspective, the more we can try to do things ourselves to see the relevance of material, or the more we can practice explaining what we're learning in our own words, or thinking about how what we're learning connects to other things that we've learned, or other classes we've had, or other experiences we've had. All of that kind of enriches that experience and increases the likelihood that we really learn and retain. Again, there are articles like the one that you already referenced, and books that are written for more general audiences, where even if you don't understand the technicalities of how it was tested, or, you know, again, what the terminology is for the science and all of that, they make it pretty accessible. So off the top of my head, there's a book called Learning, How Learning Works by Ambrose and colleagues. That, I think, is a really good one that delves into research-based principles about how our minds work. Ken Bain has written a couple books. I think Make It Stick is Ken Bain. I didn't come with a list of references, but there's all sorts of books that are rooted in the scholarship of teaching and learning. And I think those are really good starting points for educators in any context, where you can get some solid advice of, okay, in general, these are good starting points. So that's what I would say. And that's how I teach my, for example, my educational psychology courses, is that's kind of the framework. Is it's not going to give us a prescription for teaching and learning. We're not going to walk away thinking, oh, I know exactly what to do all the time and I never have to think about it again. But it can give us that starting point and help us kind of fine tune our strategies, you know, to figure out And so again, I do a lot of processing, like outward processing about my teaching in my courses, in part because I teach educational psychology. That's one of my core courses. So it, in particular, it makes sense to do that in that class, to explain to students, you know, this is why we do it this way, or this is why I asked you to do this, or, you know, when you're studying, consider doing this instead of this, and here's why. But I think I've been doing that increasingly in more of my courses, even the ones that aren't ed psych, because I think it's useful, because many students just don't take the time, many people don't take the time to like pause and just take a step back and reflect on that for a moment. And I think if you can encourage more of that, those metacognitive pauses, the more you can, you know, maybe make or force students to do it initially, the more likely students or people in general will start to do that on their own, right? To kind of question, wait a minute, why am I doing this? Or wait a minute, I believe this, but why do I believe that? Where does that come from? Is that belief even, you know, supported? Is that true? Some instructors make that easier for students to change their approach than others. So it's that constant kind of interplay. And it's, as I said, it's hard to know at the end of the day if there is a negative outcome or if something really sucks, how much of that was because the learner going into it had made up their mind that this is going to suck and or they didn't do anything. Or how much of it is because the instructor could have presented it in a different way or could have made more efforts to make it relevant and engaging.
Thank you so much for your time today. I'm so happy that you came on the show, and it was a fantastic discussion that covered so many topics I think are really valuable.
Thank you. I hope it all comes together well. Thank you for inviting me on. I thought it was a nice conversation.
If you have any ideas for topics, would like to be a guest, or want to reach out to us, send us an email at edufi@mayo.edu.